G'day and welcome to another episode of the Legalise Vaping Podcast. I'm Brian Marlow, Campaign Director for Legalise Vaping Australia. With me now are the owners of Nimbus Vapor. Nimbus Vapor have been a long-time supporter of our organisation and actually contribute to our wonderful juice line, Vape Force One Juice, which you can buy at Nimbus Vapor and in other vape shops around you. Guys, thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Look, before we get started, I'm sure there's a lot of people in the vaping community that know about Nimbus Vapor, but I wanted you to expand on, you know, a bit about your business, how you sort of came into vaping, and the point at which you decided, oh, let's actually open a vape shop and help people, you know, get away from smoking and switch to a less harmful product.
All right. So, what year we start? 2014.
God, it's going back now. Yeah,
that sounds about right. Yeah, 2014, I probably got pretty into the DIY sort of mixing thing, and obviously quit smoking with it, which was amazing. So yeah, sort of fell down the rabbit hole. We just sort of chipped away at a bunch of recipes, put them online, which at the time was a bit more loosey goosey than it is now. Mm-hmm. And then
we just sort of gradually grew from there. Started with a few recipes. People really liked them. And then we both had a sort of customer service background, so we really focused on that and just sort of gradually grew until we were doing a lot of wholesale, actually, of our liquids. And we could see that the shops that were buying our juice from us were doing well and the orders were getting bigger. So we decided to open a shop ourselves.
Well, and I think that's one of the things. So 5-6 years ago, when you guys first started, vaping was really in its infancy. So how did you go about, you know, making juices and different recipes and going through that process? Even when I think about 2.5 years ago when we started this campaign, I look at even just mods that were available in shops back then compared to now, and it's night and day, the sort of the technological advances.
Come a long way, yeah.
I mean, like, there's a lot of resources, and even back then it was a very community sort of driven thing. So a lot of websites where people would share recipes, share ideas and stuff, cloning other sort of big US manufacturers, things like that. So a lot of the resources were online. But obviously it's changed massively. So the standards are much higher now. Recipes haven't really changed much. It's all much the same sort of thing. But all the stuff around it certainly has, yeah.
Yeah, and then so from there you've then gone to open your own shop. You know, sort of set up as a brick and mortar store. What sort of regulatory hoops did you have to jump through to go through that process? And what are some examples of, you know, the regulatory bullshit, so to speak, that you have to deal with?
It wasn't so much regulatory stuff because it was such a sort of new industry. The government hadn't really caught up to properly regulating it and sort of bundled us all in with tobacco regulation, which they're still doing. But there are definitely a lot of hurdles, like trying to get facilities from banks and things like that were always difficult. Just being in an industry that wasn't really recognized, the vape industry, definitely put up a few hurdles.
Yeah, so I guess on the banking issue, we presented last year at an inquiry into debanking and into the government's move to basically ban cash transactions over $10,000. And at that inquiry, I spoke about different vape shops that are effectively deplatformed by payment providers. Is that something that's happened to you guys as well? Maybe to expand on a bit more for people that are listening, you have payment providers like Stripe and PayPal and even banks with their like card terminals that say convenience store.
We did have one issue with PayPal where they might have held some money from us for a period, but we've ended up winning that dispute. Mm-hmm. So PayPal's been pretty good, but like things like ZipPay and Afterpay and stuff for a while were not allowing vape shops to come on board for some arbitrary reason. We're not sure why. They eventually changed their mind and sort of opened it back up to everybody. But there was a period there where some facilities were saying no.
And particularly with Zip, and also when asking for like merchant facilities through Combank, they always went back to the line of high risk industry. Yeah. So you hear that a ton when you're trying to set up anything financial. So there seems to be some sort of shared idea that the vaping industry is high risk as far as transactions go.
Seems to be trickling down from on high somewhere in the financial sector.
I mean, they can never really justify what they meant by it, but it was always talking about a high risk of returns or something. I'm not quite sure.
Or fraud, maybe. They never really explained it to our satisfaction, but We had our business accounts, still do, with Commonwealth Bank, but they always refused to give us a FPOS terminal. So we ended up getting a FPOS terminal through, you know, other sources, but even though we had our business accounts with them.
Yeah, and the issue is it happens sort of sporadically. So you get different shops that have it happen at random times where, like, ZipPay or even PayPal will do a random spot check of a company and then go, oh, you fall into a high-risk category, so we're just not going to let you use our payment platform. And the end result is then you have vape shops that can't accept payment until they find another provider. And I don't really get the logic behind it. So the logic is, oh, well, it's a high-risk business because it's an illegal gray area. To which the response is, yeah, that's why you need to legislate these products so that these businesses can exist. It's not
even an illegal gray area. Everything we sell via these terminals is completely legal. So exactly. Like, even the excuse doesn't quite work for them.
No, never really made sense to our satisfaction. I mean, people are coming in using their debit cards, credit cards to pay via FPOS. I don't see how even like any industry could be more risky than another. You know, it's down to the customer. Credit card fraud happens everywhere, but there's no industry that's going to attract more of it, you know, not that I would think.
Well, I mean, not at a brick and mortar store. I mean, I can't see how vape shop's going to attract more, you know, dodgy. Yeah,
unless vapors are somehow more likely to have a stolen credit card or something. It just doesn't make any sense.
It's the scary clouds. It must equal financial fraud. Mm. So you running vape shops, you have these issues where you've got like health departments telling you that you can't display products. Then you've got payment providers sort of saying you're in high risk categories. It almost becomes, from my perspective, sometimes I think, geez, would I ever want to open a vape shop in the current regulatory model? It just seems like so much of a clusterfuck. And then you add on top of that, there was a whole anti-vaping hysteria back in, I think, August of last year. It's gone that quickly, where you had all the fake vaping deaths. Mm. Did that affect...
Public perception is almost bigger than the regulatory hurdles. Yeah. We spend a lot of time reinforming or correcting people's opinions on particularly things like that. When the THC, the dodgy THC capsules were going around in the States and killing people, all the headlines just read vaping kills, you know? So it took a lot of re-education and sort of hands-on talking to customers and sort of getting the right message out about that was not to do with vaping in general.
But yeah, you're not wrong. It's like it's an exhausting industry. You're constantly looking over your shoulder. It's kind of hard just to get the job done.
Waiting for the government to make the next move to make it harder.
Yeah, to tighten that choke point a bit more. On the whole, you know, vaping THC deaths, how did that affect your business back in August? Because I remember we had our forum at the LVA offices and sort of spoke about ways that we were going to try and campaign around that, because I know that a lot of vape shops were really feeling the crunch at that time. Did that affect you as well? There were other vape shops saying that people stopped buying starter kits, which effectively meant that smokers were staying on cigarettes as a result of fake news. Did you guys have that same experience? Can you sort of expand on that a bit more?
Yeah. So we were breaking down the numbers around that time, and it was probably like we probably lost about 30% of revenue pretty much overnight.
Jesus.
And I heard a similar number from other vendors as well, particularly the starter kits. So we used to break down the categories and see where we were, you know, where it was dropping, and starter kits were absolutely the biggest thing. And you could just notice it as well. Like on the weekends, you wouldn't get people coming in who were sort of half interested. You'd still get your hardcore vapors coming in, but you basically lost all the fresh converts from smoking. I mean, I even saw a customer at the pub the week after it all happened back on the cigarettes, and he'd been buying liquid off us for 2 years at that point.
Backwards.
He was an old bloke. He's sort of, you know, 65 or something. And I asked what he was doing, and he said, oh, mate, the vapes were killing me.
Oh, yeah, cigarettes.
He'd read the Telegraph and, you know, convinced.
So, yeah, it was huge.
Yeah, and this is something that we've spoken about on the podcast before, which is with issues like vaping, one, you know, with respect, it is for the average person considered a fringe issue, and two, it's a complex issue. So you go through several layers of having to educate people, as I'm sure you're aware, just before they actually come around to the idea of vaping. Then you throw in fake headlines saying it's killing people in the United States. And you really fall on the back foot. I mean, we're in May of 2020, and this started back in August of last year. And at my local cafe, the barista there, she smokes. And I said to her the other day, oh, you should take up vaping. I can help you out with that. I actually run an organization trying to legislate nicotine vaping, and her response was, "No, it's worse for you than cigarettes." I saw all the news about it last year, it's still there.
Yeah, and that's right. Because like you said, it's a fringe issue. If you're not going to take the time to go and search out the right information, you are going to just stick with the headline that you read six months ago. Yeah, I've had that conversation with like Uber drivers or people that aren't really in the industry or not really, you know, paying attention to it, and they've got an idea somewhere in the back of their mind, and you bring it up and they say the same thing. No, isn't that worse for you than smoking? It's just stuck.
Yeah, so on that, you know, you talk about trying to explain the importance of vaping to your Uber driver or people that you come across that smoke. For a wider audience, why do you think vaping is so important as an alternative product in Australia?
I mean, apart from the obvious, that it's...
apart from the blatantly obvious, if you want to just sort of expand on maybe even how it's helped you guys, or if you've seen customers that have, you know, had a transformation through switching over.
I mean, yeah, I mean, firsthand for us, for sure. I was never a super heavy smoker, but Jack was pretty heavy, and the colloquial evidence is super strong. Everyone who switches over, you know, says how much they feel the difference in themselves physically. Sense of smell, taste, you know, being able to breathe easier. All that's pretty pretty obvious.
Don't know how to expand on that. I mean, anything specifically?
Yeah, allow you to have your vice without the guilt of killing yourself with cancer. I mean, that's
awesome. Yeah, you managed to quit smoking and enjoy it.
I mean, nicotine gets a bad stigma too, but it's really pretty similar to caffeine. We have coffee every day. Nobody really gives a heard about that.
Yeah, there's a weird
nicotine sort of itself is not a carcinogen, but a lot of people conflate that, I think, the actual nicotine with the negative.
Well, I think that's where the confusion comes. People will hear nicotine and they think cigarettes, and they don't understand that nicotine's not actually the harmful chemical. It's burning the goddamn leaf and then inhaling. I mean,
in high concentrations, it's poisonous, but so is caffeine.
So is water.
Exactly, everything in moderation, right? So it's a mild stimulant. It actually has some mild benefits, you know, like memory recall and things like that. Obviously, I'm not trying to say everyone should be taking nicotine, but it shouldn't have the negative stigma that it has.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key things that sort of needs to be cut through. And obviously, you know, our organization's main goal is to legalize nicotine vaping in Australia, but we also want to have a fairer regulatory framework under the existing laws anyway. So on that, you know, what are some things the government could do today? Obviously, yep, sure, they can legalize and legislate nicotine vaping as well. But for your day-to-day operations, what could they do today to help your business run more smoothly and sort of get rid of some of the headaches that you guys have to deal with?
I feel like if they just released and put more effort into studying it and then releasing information which wasn't so spooky. I mean, like just like Jordan mentioned, the public perception is probably the hardest thing to get over at times. So, I mean, if you look at England and the studies they're putting out, I'm sure if you ask the average Joe on the street what they thought about vaping, it'd be far less extreme than what you see here. So, yeah, I just think getting the studies in, getting the information out there, it would be huge.
Public perception, that'd be massive. The mixed messages is huge, and the media doesn't help. So yeah, if the government came on board and said, right, we're looking at this and here are the benefits and actually we're honest about it, that would be massive. But yeah, nicotine is by far like the, on a day-to-day basis with customers, trying to explain to customers that we can't sell them nicotine and they have to go, you know, jump through hoops in order to get some, and that's really what's going to help them stop smoking. That is a massive thing. And that would put off a lot of people that might come in and go, right, I'm going to quit smoking.
Yeah,
but then once they hear what they have to do in order to get the nicotine, that's...
Well, they've got to wait 3 to 4 days and go through that process.
And some people aren't comfortable online buying stuff overseas. They just want to come into a shop, talk to someone who can tell them what to do, and give them what they need, and we just can't do that.
And I'm going to ask a very stupid question. Sometimes I think about getting the LVA crew to go to a work experience day at a couple of vape shops. Is this something that you have to deal with every single day? Like, is this a conversation that every day someone comes in and goes, hi, I want to switch to vaping because I read a thing that says it's less harmful. Can I buy everything, including my nicotine?
Definitely. And every day. It means every transaction. I mean, not that I think this is a bad thing, because I think spending time with customers is, you know, it's part of the business, right? Yeah. But it turns what would be a 5 to 10 minute transaction into a 30 to 45 minute one.
Yeah.
And for some people who find it hard to grasp the concept of, you know, just mixing things.
Doing
a
bit of maths. To work out how much you have to add. Some people aren't up to that either. And yeah, there's a lot of barriers for some people.
Yeah. And that's just the nicotine. So then you've got to explain the devices and stuff, which is going to be par for the course. But yeah, it definitely adds a lot of time with each customer, for sure.
Which is kind of why we went the opposite way that a lot of industries do. We started online and then went to brick and mortar.
Yeah.
A lot of retail will go the other way. And it's because there is so much need for hands-on customer service. People really do need to be explained how to use these devices properly and, you know, how to get the nicotine. So much information to disseminate.
Yeah, it's a steeper learning curve. I mean, a cigarette's pretty easy. You put it in your mouth, you light the other end, and away you go.
Yeah, you can't really step it up.
Yeah, exactly. With a vape, it's quite a process and can be a bit of a steep learning curve. Do you find, you know, someone comes in, they say, hey, I want to switch over. So they want to get a starter kit and they want to just get away from cigarettes once and for all. How many of them, once you explain, actually you need to, you can buy the product from us, you can buy the liquid, you can buy the mod. But if you actually want to get the nicotine, you need to get it from, say, New Zealand or any other overseas country. How many of them go, oh, don't worry about it, and then just leave?
Not many. I think we've gotten pretty good at it, I think. You know, spotting what people need and what they're after after a few years of doing this in retail. So, you know, look, most people, once they've made the decision to walk in the door, probably are willing to hear you out and see what it takes. And we sort of have streamlined that process for them as well. But yeah, you get a few that, you know, might say, oh, look, I'm just going to stick with my Juul, because they try one of those in America and they come pre-filled with nicotine. It's much more expensive and much more wasteful and more landfill. But some people will just go, too hard, and we'll stick with something like that. But most of the time we can convert them over.
Yeah, just on Juul products, one thing that I always find funny is when I meet with MPs, if they know something about vaping and they're not, like, let's say they're not a hardcore supporter, but they're broadly supportive of the idea and they don't actually know anything about the world of vaping, the thing they'll bring up is like, oh, okay, so like legalizing Juul pods. It's like, well, yeah, that's part of it. Like, if Juul wants to sell, then I don't really care. But it's interesting, because for the average person, they just think that it's maybe a Juul or something like that. And they don't realize like how many better products there are in the vaping scene, where there are so many better pod style vapes that actually make a Juul seem pretty shitty. So it's one of these things that we always try and educate policymakers through, which is this is an ever evolving industry where even vapes from a year ago are pretty much defunct now and out of date. Pod vapes, I think when we started our campaign, there weren't that many pods available in shops. They were, you know, big like Vupu Drags and all that kind of stuff. It's like night and day seeing the industry evolve. Within your own shop, have you seen a lot of that? Like, you know, what would you say are sort of your bread and butter starter kits that you're starting to sell now versus, you know, when you first opened your shop?
I mean, there's certain kits that we still sell from, you know, from the beginning, just because they're sort of, some just sort of well built and they stand the test of time. But yeah, most devices are getting smaller and better. So I think most people tend to want, something pod sized at the very least.
Pod and salts really change the game.
Salts change the game for sure. Nicotine salts.
So for me, who also care about this issue and really want to see this pushed across, I actually know nothing about the difference between freebase and salts. What's the benefit of salts versus the call it old school liquids?
Freebase. So salts and freebase. Basically, it's a different molecular form of nicotine where they've bound it to a salt to make it more stable. Less volatile. It basically means you can get away with higher levels of nicotine without it getting too harsh and really, really hurting your throat. With regular freebase, if you go above sort of 9 or 10, I mean, everyone's different in their tolerance, but if you go above sort of 9, 10 milligram, it gets very, very harsh and hurts your throat. So salts basically allow you to use these really low power devices like pods that don't produce very much vapor and get a bit more nicotine in the liquid so that you can balance out the satisfaction that way. Otherwise, if you're using the nicotine in a pod, the combination of low nic and low power probably wouldn't be as satisfying.
Right, okay.
Salt is what Juul uses. So they
yeah.
35 milligram or 50 milligram.
Did they pioneer that? I'm not sure if they were the first, but they would have been up there with the first to use the salts.
Possibly. I'm sure I've read some sort of link there, but anyway, that's worth researching.
Okay, gotcha. So effectively, salts sort of lend themselves better to a pod-style vape than, say, a big open system.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, there you have it. Guys, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. For anyone listening, Nimbus Vapor is one of our core supporters of the campaign and have been involved with us for the long haul. So, guys, I really appreciate you jumping onto our podcast. And if anyone would like to buy our vaping juice that's produced by Nimbus Vape, you can go to our website, legalizevaping.com.au. We have details about where you can get these juices in a vape shop near you and support the campaign. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks, mate.